My name is Charles Goodhart, and it's a great pleasure for me to introduce Professor Ben Friedman. It's a particular pleasure because I've always seen Ben as a younger, brighter, and particularly better-looking version of myself. We both did graduate work at Cambridge and then at Harvard. We've both done monetary economics for most of our lives. We've both tried to claw back or curtail the wilder excesses of monetarism while having a certain sympathy for it. We used both to get invited to Karl Brunner's Konstanz seminar, which was a kind of propaganda area. And we both tried to tell the world that the asset side of banks' balance sheets were as important as the liability side. Well, I'm glad to say that I think that we've actually won this battle, and that monetary economics is now in a much more consensual and sensible stage than it ever has been. Partly as a result, having slain all his dragons, Ben Friedman found monetary economics no longer quite as enthralling and encompassing all his energies as it had before. So he's been turning his mind to an even wider canvas, which is the relationship between economic developments and wider social developments in our nations more broadly. So Ben, we look forward to your talk.
Thank you, Charles. That was a very kind and warm, and I must say a very unusual form of introduction. As you were outlining the similarities between us, I was sitting over there nodding and saying yes, 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 until you got to the line about showing some sympathy for monetarism as a way of conducting monetary policy. People used to talk about monetarist jokes, and the question would be, how many monetarist jokes are there? And the answer is only two, because all of those other stories are true. Now, the issue that I want to address with you this evening is rather different. The easiest way to pose the matter that I want to address is to ask the following question: why do we care so much about economic growth? Why does it matter to us as much as it obviously does whether our incomes continue to rise or not? To take the example that's most current in my country, there has been for the past 4 to 6 months an intense debate among economists, both in the academic world and also in the central bank and also in the business community, about whether the United States is either in or about to incur a business recession. To read the front page of the newspaper, it becomes immediately obvious that whether the country is in a recession is a matter of great import to a wide variety of people, and having a recession would be considered a very bad thing. Now, what is a business recession? In the United States, it means that people's incomes go down by approximately 2%. This lasts approximately 10 to 12 months, after which the growth of incomes resumes. Yet somehow the public clearly thinks that this is a very bad thing. Now, in asking a question like, why do we care so much about our incomes, it's important to specify who the we is intended to be. Because there are many countries in the world in which growth in per capita incomes translates very directly into improvements in such matters as life expectancy, reduced infant mortality, increased literacy, reduced morbidity of a variety of sorts. And so in countries where that is true, the answer to why people care so much or would care so much about having economic growth seems pretty easy. But once a country gets much above a level that I would identify as perhaps half of the per capita income of the UK, To take some examples, once a country gets to the level of, say, Portugal in Europe, or to the level of Korea in Asia, the systematic relationship between rising incomes on the one hand and improvements in life expectancy and infant mortality and morbidity and literacy all disappears. There is simply no systematic relationship left above the level of income of a Portugal or a Korea. I therefore want to suggest a different hypothesis that offers the potential of explaining why we care so much about incomes, and in particular why we care so much about our incomes rising, and that is that rising incomes broadly distributed throughout the society make it easier for a society to realize and enhance the likelihood that a society will realize such characteristics as openness of opportunity, tolerance, mobility, fairness, certainly fairness across groups and perhaps even fairness across individuals, although that's much harder to analyze in an economic context. Commitment to democratic political institutions where they already exist, and the creation of new democratic institutions where they didn't exist before. All of these dimensions of a society's character that, since the thinking of the Enlightenment at least, we have come to identify as having positive moral value. Now, if true, I'm going to argue that this hypothesis has a variety of extremely important implications. Before coming to the implications, though, I want first to consider why we might think this relationship between rising living standards on the one side and these political, social, moral characteristics of the society on the other side might be so. To use economist language, what is the model? What is the process that leads one development to foster the other? And I also want to have some overview of what the evidence is that would lead one to suspect that this hypothesis not only might be true, but in fact is likely to be so. So first, what is the story? What is the economic argument by which we might think it plausibly true that increasing living standards, again broadly distributed throughout the society, might foster these characteristics like openness and democracy and tolerance? I want to suggest that there are four steps in the argument, of which the first three are sufficient to make the argument, but then the last one enhances the force of the argument. Step one, I hope, should be broadly familiar to most people, and that is that we care about our living standards not as an absolute matter, but rather relative to something else. Now, this is an old idea. In the economics literature, it dates at least to Adam Smith, who has these lovely passages about why it is that the world as he knew it, a worker would be embarrassed to be seen without a clean linen shirt on, whereas by contrast, leather shoes were something that it was necessary for everyone to wear in England, but necessary only for men to wear in Scotland, and not necessary for either men or women to wear in France. And Smith goes on in this vein for quite a while, and the point clearly is that our notion of an acceptable living standard is a relative thing. We have no absolute notion of what it means to have an appropriate living standard. I think this is probably the reason why most countries other than my own, I should say, have a relative standard for judging poverty. Poverty in most countries around the world is defined as some a living standard that is some fraction of the median, in a few countries some fraction of the mean, but usually it's the median. In my country it's not done that way, but we're the outlier in this regard. And my colleague Amartya Sen has even pointed out that our notions of what constitutes an adequate subsistence diet are a matter of relative comparisons also. Sen makes the point that even though physical well-being depends positively on nutrition intake over quite a wide range, even in countries where the average intake per day is well interior to that range, it's nonetheless true that what's considered an adequate subsistence diet is still a matter of relative comparisons. So step one in the argument is that we care about our incomes not absolutely, but relative to something else. Step two is that when it comes to deciding what the something else is, there are two standards of comparison that heavily influence behavior in most societies. Those are, in particular, how am I doing compared to my own or my family's past experience, what we might think of as an inward, internal, backward-looking benchmark. So that, for example, if I imagine offering somebody a job that pays £50,000 a year, I have no idea how excited he or she is going to be about this prospect until I know whether the person's current job pays $40,000 or $75,000. And depending upon which one it is, a job that pays £50,000 might look either very attractive or very unattractive. The second benchmark that I want to argue has importance here is the external benchmark of looking around at others within one's community. This too has a broad history in the economics literature, usually either called the relative income hypothesis. This is an older phrase for it. More recently, the technical literature uses the phrase either keeping up with the Joneses or catching up with the Joneses, depending upon the specification of particular dynamics in the relationship that doesn't concern us here. The particular form of this idea that I want to have in mind is that people are continually asking themselves two questions. How am I doing compared to what I thought life would be like when I started my career? How am I doing compared to what it was like when I was a child in my parents' house? For young people just starting off their careers, how is my career prospect looking compared to what I remember from my uncles and my aunts? Things like that. Now, finally, the third element of the theoretical structure behind this idea is that these two sources of a sense of well-being or a sense of satisfaction with one's standard of living are strictly substitutes for one another. And I'm using the word substitute in the classical economic sense, in which, for example, if you've already just eaten several dishes of chocolate ice cream and I now offer you a dish of vanilla ice cream, the fact that you have just eaten the chocolate ice cream will strictly reduce the eagerness with which you will attack the bowl of vanilla ice creams. I want to argue that these two sources of satisfaction are substitutable for one another. Now, the implication that immediately arises from this is that if, by and large across the population, most people are satisfied with how they're doing on one of these standards of comparison, they are on that account less concerned with how they're doing on the other one. So, for example, if we all lived in Garrison Keillor's Lake Wobegon, and therefore everybody had an income that was greater than the average, then people would attach less urgency to getting ahead compared to their own or their family's past experience. Well, of course, that's fiction and that can't happen. But by contrast, not only can it happen that the bulk of the population lives better than it has and better than its family has in the past, that is exactly what I mean and will continue to mean by economic growth, namely rising standards of living broadly distributed throughout the society. This is not a story about GDP growth narrowly defined, which might accrue to only a small segment of the population. This is a story about the broad swath of the population living better than it did before. And if it's true that we care about our living standards and our incomes on a relative basis, and if it's true that we have these two standards of comparison, one internal and one external, and finally, if it's true that they are strict substitutes for one another, then the consequence of economic growth, as I've defined it, is that people attach less urgency to their eagerness to live better than other people, to the extent that they value things like fairness or a democratic society that or mobility or tolerance that lets other people have a chance as well. They are more likely to be willing to indulge those preferences or even to be willing to pay for them. And to the extent that they have opportunities to preclude other people or other people's children from having the same opportunities that they have and that their children have, for example, through hiring, for example, through exclusive practices in social circumstances, they will be less likely to do that. So those three elements of the story are sufficient to deliver the argument that I want. But I want to add one further element in order to make the argument stronger, not just because it's nice to have a stronger argument, but because I'm persuaded the evidence is there to support it, and that is that people behave in a wide variety of circumstances according to what Kahneman and Tversky have called loss aversion. That is to say that the importance people attach to any deterioration in their circumstances compared to what they have already greatly outweighs the extent to which they attach importance to gains from their current circumstances, so that when we assess the value of this gaining ground, losing ground argument, especially when it comes to things like these relative comparisons that I have in mind, there is an asymmetry that we're able to invoke so that the losing ground has a lot more importance in people's mind than the gaining ground. So that, in short, is the economic logic, and this is not the right setting to go into a detailed, much less a mathematical, exposition of the idea, but I hope on the basis of this intuitive guide to the four elements that I think constitute essential parts of the story, you can get some sense of what the model would look like if I were to go through that. Now, having an argument whereby a hypothesis might be true is one thing, but establishing that it is true is another matter altogether. So the main burden of what I want to say next is to argue that there are three different classes of evidence to which one can point that I think provide persuasive ground for believing that this evidence connecting economic growth as I've defined it to the moral character of a society not only might be true, but is. The three categories of evidence that I have in mind are first psychological or data from the psychology literature, mostly drawn from surveys. Second, especially for the developing world, work with cross-country data on incomes and income growth and various characteristics of the society that we might hope to quantify. And third, evidence of a non-quantitative nature from the countries for which we have not only political and social histories, but also per capita income data going back quite a ways. So let me summarize the evidence that I have in mind here. To begin, there is an overwhelming, I would say, at least by an economist's standard, there is an overwhelming amount of evidence in the psychology literature to back up the notion that income and living standards are things that we care about in a relative way, not an absolute way, and also to back up the notion not only of what we call habit formation, namely the internal standard, but also a relative income hypothesis, the external standard. This is a very large literature, and to do it justice would require many one-hour lectures, not just a piece of one. But let me give you just what I think is the most striking example of evidence in favor of the relative income hypothesis. Back around the late 1950s, a group of social scientists went around the world asking people in different countries some question that amounted to, how satisfied are you with your life? And what they found was, of course, that within any one country, people with middle incomes were more satisfied than people with low incomes, and people with high incomes were more satisfied than people with middle incomes. Well, what else is new? We understood that. But the striking finding, which received an enormous amount of attention in this literature at the time, was that on average, across countries, there was no systematic relationship between the average level of satisfaction reported in any given country and the per capita income average in that country. So the relative income idea seemed to work within countries, but not across countries. And for the next two decades, this finding received an enormous amount of attention. It received so much attention that by the mid-80s, somebody decided to do it again. And so in the mid-80s, a team of psychologists again went around the world asking people in different countries some question like that translates into, how satisfied are you with your life? And once again, of course, they found that middle-income people were more satisfied than low-income people, and rich people are more satisfied than middle-income people within any one country. But now, instead of having no relationship across countries, now there was almost a perfect lineup across countries, in which the high-income countries like the Swiss and the Norwegians and the Americans were more satisfied with their lives than the Germans and the French, and the Germans and the French were more satisfied than the Greeks and the Portuguese, and the Greeks and the Portuguese were in turn more satisfied with than other folks, and so forth. Now, one might pause and say, this is very interesting. Why? What could account for this dramatic difference? And then all of a sudden the answer leaps out at you. The answer, of course, is television. In the late 1950s, the first time the study was done, it was natural to think that people in Spain had as their image of comparison, when they thought about whom to compare themselves to, other Spaniards, and similarly in Norway at the other end of the European spectrum. But by the mid-1980s, the advent of television was such that people throughout Europe, and indeed in this study throughout a much broader swath of the world, were all comparing themselves to the standard middle-class lifestyles. Well, the short of it is that there is, from the psychological literature, a very large amount of data now that support these relative income concepts. And incidentally, there's also a large amount of data from both surveys and experimental data supporting the idea of loss aversion in a variety of different forms. People are reluctant to part with what they have, compared to their eagerness to acquire something new. In the stock market, for example, investors are reluctant to realize losses, much more so than they are to book gains. In the health and personal safety and risk field, which incidentally is the one in which loss aversion seems to be the most extreme, people are willing to pay very large amounts to avoid incurring a new risk to their health or personal safety if it is portrayed to them as something new, compared to what they say they would be willing to pay to get rid of the exact same risk if it is phrased to them as a risk that they're already bearing. So there's a large amount of evidence there. The second kind of evidence that I want to mention, and here I have in mind especially the developing world, has to do with cross-country evidence linking economic growth to the creation of democratic political institutions or to the durability, the robustness of democracy where democracy already exists. Now, this is a very old idea in some respects, although the oldest aspect of the idea, which incidentally can be found in Aristotle's Politics. Aristotle has a nice statement that as incomes rise, a country or a polis, as he would have put it, becomes more inclined towards supporting a democracy. But the Aristotle idea is not exactly what I'm pushing, because again, Aristotle had in mind the level of income, and he thought in terms of static societies, societies were either permanently poor or permanently rich, and the Aristotle idea was that a permanently poor society was not a fertile place for democracy, as he knew it, and by contrast, a permanently rich society was. So I'm not pushing exactly the Aristotle idea, I'm pushing rather the idea that it's economic growth that matters. And here the two thinkers to whom I would point are more recent. One is Lipset. Lipset has a large amount of work on how, this is Seymour Martin Lipset, the sociologist, has written about the need, especially in a new democracy, to establish legitimacy of that form of government. So ask the question, let's imagine that Saddam Hussein, for example, met his demise tomorrow and some democratic form of government was miraculously put in place in his stead. How could this government acquire legitimacy in a part of the world where the citizens haven't known democratic form of government in the past? And the Lipset answer is that providing for increasing standards of living, or at least presiding over increasing standards of living, is the central and main way that new democracies can do that. My own former colleague Albert Hirschman had a somewhat different idea, which resonates with, but is not at all the same thing as the Lipset idea. Hirschman was who was also a keen student of democracy in developing countries, primarily in Latin America, had the idea that conflict is good for the building of democracy when conflict can be resolved. This is like a marriage theory. This is like the notion that a marriage where there's never any argument over anything is not as strong a marriage as a marriage in which things actually arise that you have to have a disagreement over. And then, of course, if you don't manage to resolve that disagreement, that's not good. But if you do resolve the disagreement, that makes the marriage stronger. Well, this may or may not be true in the marriage business. I don't want to hold myself out as having examined this prospect. But Hirschman argued that it certainly is true in the business of building democracies in countries. And he related this to economic growth in the following argument, the idea is that economic growth creates social conflict of a variety of forms, and we certainly have a lot of evidence that that is true. But economic growth also, of course, creates and provides the wherewithal by which many of those conflicts can be resolved. And moreover, an interesting aspect of the Hirschman hypothesis was that the specific forms of conflict that economic growth creates tend to be what he called divisible conflicts. That is to say, conflicts along the lines that if you and I disagree, you can go away with something, maybe not all that you want, and I can go away with something, maybe not all I want, but we can both go away feeling we've gotten something. As opposed to, for example, to take the most obvious example in my country of a disagreement that is not divisible, the disagreement over abortion. The Hirschman idea is that the conflicts that economic growth tends to create are divisible conflicts, like should we have schools or should we have hospitals? And the whole point is that with economic growth providing resources, you can have both schools and hospitals, and then in a way that resonates certainly with the Tocqueville approach to building a democracy. The idea that Hirschman then pushes is that if a society faces conflicts and successfully resolves them, that builds a strong democracy. Well, what is the evidence? To begin, there have been a variety of studies looking at the level of a country's democracy as measured, for example, by the Freedom House Index, as measured, for example, by the Humana Index. The Humana Index may not be familiar to most people. It differs from the Freedom House Index in a variety of ways. The most obvious one from an American perspective is that whether a country has capital punishment or not is part of the Humana Index. It's not part of the Freedom House Index. And if you happen to live in a country where there is capital punishment, which I do, this is clearly a major factor. So for this reason, most American economists who do this kind of work use the Freedom House Index, not the Humana Index. But the evidence is very clear that the level of democracy, in the sense of political rights, civil liberties, political rights meaning who gets to vote, when you vote, are you really voting for the people who have a chance to, does the opposition have a chance to win? If they win, are they really going to run the show? Civil liberties in the standard sense of freedom of the press, freedom to assemble, freedom of religion, and so forth. There's a strong positive relationship between a country's level of democracy as measured by these indexes and its level of its income level, and if you control for the right other things, there's also a relationship with the economic growth rate. Now, my colleague Robert Barrow has argued persuasively, I think, that whether or not there's a relationship between growth and democracy in this context, in which economic growth creates democracy, there's also the prospect that democracy creates economic growth. And if that's true, then I think this makes this idea all the more interesting, because it creates the opportunity for either virtuous cycles in which there's a democracy, this helps the economy grow, this in turn makes the democracy stronger, this helps the economy grow faster, and so forth, or vicious cycles that work in the other direction. And the interesting finding, I think, from the Barrow work on whether democracy is good for growth or not is that he finds that the answer is nonlinear. That is to say, moving from very low levels of democracy to medium levels of democracy enhances economic growth, presumably because it opens up the opportunity for more efficient use of a society's resources. And by contrast, moving from middle levels of democracy to very high levels of democracy tends, all other things equal, to depress economic growth. And so what the Barrow finding, taken together with this other work, means is that, alas, the prospect for vicious cycles is much greater than the prospect for virtuous cycles. There's also a great deal of evidence that we have, again, on a cross-country basis, and again, I'm thinking here, too, of evidence mostly from the developing world, about the stability of democracies where they exist, exactly as you would guess under the Lipset hypothesis and also under the Hirschman hypothesis. The probability that any given democracy will undergo a transition to a dictatorship is significantly greater if there is negative growth than positive growth. And indeed, the relationship is roughly 3-1. That is to say, if you have some new democracy, if it has a negative growth rather than positive growth, that roughly, all other things equal, triples the prospect that that new democracy will collapse into a dictatorship. The third category of evidence that I want to say something about, albeit briefly in the interest of time, is the historical experience of countries like the UK, and like mine, in which we have not only the social and political history at our disposal to work with, albeit in a form that's very difficult to quantify, but we also have good data going back well into the past on per capita incomes. And the use of that data that I want to argue supports the hypothesis I'm advancing comes in the form of asking why things happen when they do. So let me just cite an example or two from my own country's experience. Take, for example, attitudes toward immigrants. Always an interesting topic in the United States, where at a certain level everybody is an immigrant, but of course people who've been there for a generation or two come no longer to think of themselves as immigrants and think of the other people, the more recent arrivals, as immigrants. So attitudes toward immigrants has been a very important part of the American experience since day one. So ask the following set of questions. Why did we have the anti-immigrant violence that we had in the 1850s? And why did it go away, which it did, after the Civil War? And then why did we have in the 1880s and 1890s a very ugly form of anti-immigrant agitation that lasted for almost two decades? And then after the turn of the 20th century, why did that radically turn around? And what I mean by radically turning around is not that people no longer had prejudices. They certainly did, but the whole emphasis then shifted from excluding or seeking to exclude immigrants to welcoming them and Americanizing them. This was, incidentally, the period when the whole notion of what we call a high school, I've forgotten what the word, I guess a state school here that goes beyond the age 13 or 14, this was the whole period when America, not at the national level, but at the state level, led what became a world movement toward high schools with standardized curricula. And a part of that was a whole new word. It was called social studies. Nobody had ever used the word social studies before. What this meant was Americanizing the immigrants, teaching them various forms of civic values. And it sounds amusing today, but from the perspective of 100 years, we have to give the people credit. It worked. Well, that was the period after the first maybe two decades of the 20th century. And then why did that turn around after World War after World War I, so that in the 1920s we had not only anti-immigrant agitation, but the most extreme form of immigration restrictions that the United States has ever had, things like the what was called the Quota Act and then the National Origins Act, in which it was not only tight limits on immigration from Europe, but it depended upon which part of Europe you came from. So if you came from Poland, that was a different quota than if you came from Norway. And then to continue the story up to the current era, why is it that the whole Quota Act and national origin system was just completely thrown out and the immigration system liberalized in the 1960s? Why is it that beginning in the 1980s and up through the early 90s, there was again a renewal of anti-immigrant agitation? There were a variety of proposals in Congress to limit legal immigration, to further restrict legal immigration, never actually passed, but a lot of agitation. Why is it that in heavy immigrant states like California and Texas and Florida, there were things, the most famous, I suppose, were Proposition 209 in California, which was a ballot proposal which eliminated aid to immigrants in a variety of ways, some of which is quite self-destructive. You have to have a particular mindset to want to deny immigrants' children the right to vaccination against communicable diseases. If you think through the logic of sending your child out to the playground and not knowing who the other children in the baseball game are, you don't have to think about that very hard to think that it would be very nice to have the other children vaccinated as well. But yet we had people in these high incidentally, almost all American immigration goes to only 6 states out of the 50. So it's a very localized issue. So this all was taking place in the early 90s, and now here we arrive at the late 90s, and I suppose the turn of the 21st century, and the easiest way to put the status of our immigration debate now is simply to ask the question, why is it that Pat Buchanan, who has made his political career on this issue, and who was such a force in the 1992 election, and less of a force, but still pretty visible in the 1996 election, got so little support in 2000, even within the Republican Party, that he had to leave the Republican Party altogether and run as an independent, and he still didn't get any votes. So the whole question is why. There is a pattern to these things. They come and go. I'll cite only one more example, again, in the interest of time, again, a central issue that's has for a very long time been absolutely at the top of the American agenda is race relations. Why is it that the what we call Jim Crow legislation was a product not of the immediate post-Civil War period, which it wasn't, but a product mostly of the 1880s and 90s? And then why did we have this period after the turn of the century in which some aspects of Jim Crow legislation were either thrown out by the courts or otherwise rolled back? Famously, school segregation was not thrown out, but some aspects were. Things like, for example, segregated housing, which were legislated in a variety of places in the 1880s and 1890s. It's an example of de jure segregated housing was thrown out after the turn of the century. And we had a rather dramatic turnaround. This is what was called in the arts, this is what was called the Harlem Renaissance. This was the founding and flourishing of the NAACP. We move forward. Why is it that in the 1920s we then had the revival of the Ku Klux Klan? It's hard to believe today, but the evidence seems to suggest that somewhere between 1 out of 8 and 1 out of 12 eligible Americans belonged to the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. Hard to believe. Ku Klux Klan, unlike our modern image in those days, was not particularly southern, nor was it particularly rural. The main center of the Klan was in the state of Indiana. The city with the largest Klan representation was Chicago. In second place was Detroit. In third place was Indianapolis. In fourth place was Philadelphia. So this is a very widespread phenomenon. Why did this occur? And then again, leaping forward, why did we then have the very dramatic era of civil rights legislation beginning in the late 1950s, and then, of course, especially in the 1960s, and on into the first part of the 70s, and then why did it pretty much stop? And in the 1980s and 90s, early part of the 90s, we had what I suppose the cutting edge of race relations in America was what we could call the retreat from affirmative action. And now here we are at the turn of the 21st century, and even the affirmative action debate seems now to have ended with a very interesting compromise in which the agreement seems to be that the opponents of affirmative action are allowed to say that they won, but the facts on the ground are that the effects of affirmative action are still in place and will continue to be in place, even though nobody is allowed to call it affirmative action anymore. So there is one could cite many other examples. The main point that I want to argue is that not just in the United States, and even in the United States, not just with respect to race relations and attitudes toward immigrants, but in terms of things like who gets to vote, what do people vote about, in terms of how generous we are with respect to the less advantaged, what we're prepared to do to improve opportunities, what steps we take to preclude exploitation of the disadvantaged, questions like when did child labor legislation come into play, all of these things in the United States as well as in other countries, including this one, seem to have a pattern which I want to argue supports the idea that when incomes are rising, again, broadly distributed throughout the society, then things happen in these various political and social dimensions that enhance the openness and the tolerance and the democratic vitality of a society. And by contrast, when incomes stop growing, or worse yet, retreat or deteriorate, erode, then there's at best a stagnation and in many cases an atrophication along these various dimensions. Now, finally, let me conclude by saying something about what I think the implications of this hypothesis are, if indeed it is true. And I think there are several implications that are interesting and indeed important. The first is a very optimistic implication, and that is that if it is true that rising incomes rather than the level of income foster openness and tolerance and democracy, then in many parts of the developing world it should not be necessary to have to wait until countries achieve what we now think of as Western income levels before one would see substantial evidence of liberalization, democratization, and indeed this has already happened in a variety of places throughout the developing world. To take the one most obvious example that many people are paying attention to at the moment, especially in my country, I would take as a test case of this hypothesis the implication that not just within the lifetime of the students here, but within my lifetime, I would expect to see substantial political liberalization in China. And I say that as within my lifetime, because even if the Chinese continue on their current economic trajectory, they will not have reached a Western living standard in material terms within my lifetime. But I would expect to see substantial liberalization anyway. If that's the optimistic implication of this hypothesis, there's then a second implication, which is, if not outright pessimistic, then at least somewhat alarming. And that is that if what matters for this purpose is not the level of income, but rather the growth of incomes, then no matter how rich a society becomes, its core values, again, values like democracy, fairness, tolerance, openness, its core values continue to be at risk. What are they at risk of? They are at risk of economic stagnation. And I think the experience in one country after another, for which we have the data on incomes to match the political and social data, show that when these countries, even though they have already achieved a fairly high income level, undergo an economic stagnation, bad things tend to happen, and there's a retreat from these various values. The third implication that I will indicate is an implication for public policy, and that is that if economic growth, in the sense of broadly distributed rising incomes, has these positive effects, we have to remember these are effects that the market does not price. The market does not price tolerance. It does not price openness. It does not price democracy. And this means that there is a standard externality argument in favor of economic growth. It means that it's simply wrong to believe that the market left to its own devices will provide adequate economic growth. It's no more right to think that the market left to its own devices will provide the right amount of economic growth than it is to think that the market left to its own devices will provide the right kind of economic growth, by which I mean polluting versus non-polluting factories and such like. And just as in the case of negative externalities, there's a rationale for public policy to intervene to correct the market's over-provision of certain things. Here as well, there is a rationale for a role for public policy to correct the market's tendency to under-provide economic growth as a whole. This leads me to the final implication of this hypothesis, with which I want to conclude, and this is the most general one of all. If it's true that economic growth, again in this sense of rising incomes broadly distributed, has these consequences of enhancing a society's openness and tolerance and commitment to democracy, then our public conversation, at least in my country, but I think more generally, our public conversation about economic growth is seriously incomplete. Over the years, we have increasingly come to be aware of, and appropriately aware of, negative externalities associated with growth, most obviously environmental degradation, but other things as well. And appropriately, we have come to regard those negative externalities in moral terms. We talk about biodiversity, we talk about extinction of species, we ask about our standing compared to future generations to use up non-depletable resources and so forth. By contrast, when we talk in our public conversation about the benefits of economic growth, we tend to think in material terms. How many cars, how many televisions, how many telephones, what size houses do we live in, that sort of thing. The result is that our conversation about growth often has the flavor of pitting negatives that we construe in moral terms against positives that we construe in material terms, so that the strength of one's preferences with regard to material things versus moral things therefore maps into a view about being either for or against economic growth. The presumption is that people who heavily value material things are for economic growth, people who heavily value moral things are against economic growth. And I think the broadest implication of the hypothesis that I'm putting before you is that that's seriously and perhaps dangerously incomplete. That if it's true that economic growth also has these positive moral externalities, then there is no mapping from one's preferences of the material versus the moral into one's approach toward more growth or less growth. That transference is simply invalid, and one has to get down to the more serious business of looking at public policy measures and talking about the right amount of growth and the right kind of growth. And I think that's, if all this leads in that direction, it will have done a good day's work. Thank you.
I think so. Professor Friedman has agreed to give answers to questions that you may have. I must say, a remarkably apt conclusion for a May Day lecture. Can I have any questions from over there?
How do you see this relationship affecting the situation in Russia and this, you know, a similar situation where there's declining economic growth and appearing to be declining democracy with, you know, controls over media and the like?
Yeah, very pessimistically, my sense is that what's going on in Russia now has the flavor of the kind of downward spiral that we saw nearly a half a century ago, for example, in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, where when the colonial powers departed, there was a functioning economy, albeit at a pretty low income level, and there was this implantation of a not very genuine democracy, and in ways that fed upon one another, the economy did badly, and the artificial democracy became some sort of a dictatorial regime, and the economy then did worse, and then the dictatorial regime became a genuinely oppressive dictatorial regime, and then the economy became a real basket case, and that we now have 40 years later, the sub-Saharan African countries, in many cases with lower per capita income levels than they had then, so growth has actually been negative. The semblance of democracy in most of those countries has gone, and moreover, we've had these horrible human tragedies. And I'm not a Russia expert, so I don't want to predict anything like that, particularly in Russia. But it seems to fit the pattern in which the economy is doing badly, the semblance of democracy that they appeared to have after the collapse of the Soviet Union is certainly atrophying, and the economy is doing worse. Incidentally, the Russian case is one in which the point that I kept repeatedly emphasizing about the broad distribution of the rise in incomes is very important. What's happening to the median income in Russia is very much worse than what you would get by just dividing the GDP by the number of people. Why? Because under the Russian circumstances at the moment, a quite tiny slice of the population is getting claim to an enormous part of the fruits of what production there is. So for exactly the reason that I think you have in mind, my own non-expert view of the Russian situation is extremely pessimistic.
Jeffrey?
My three questions were prompted by a fascinating, very adventurous lecture. Thank you. The questions go back, I think, to the intellectual foundations at the very beginning. Some use was made of the notion of loss aversion. How exactly does that differ in its implications from the more traditional economist's notion of diminishing marginal utility? Secondly, I was fascinated by the description of comparisons of how well off people felt across generations and across countries. What exactly was the unit of measurement that allowed these extremely interesting comparisons to be made? And thirdly, the kind of preference functions you described, the interdependent linked functions, are really quite different from the ones that underlie traditional price theory. Traditional price theory has proved a very powerful tool for analysing the world, including, for example, the non-linear relationship between growth and democracy that Robert Barrow identified. Does this new preference map that you've outlined for us give us a price theory which is as useful as the old one?
Well, let me answer the questions in the order in which I have something to say. The answer to your second question is I don't know. And that doesn't mean that it's not knowable, but I do not happen to carry around in my head the form of the question that that was asked in these surveys. But this is knowable, and indeed, if you want me to send me you can send me an email and I will look it up, or you could look it up. The source on the early surveys is a book by Cantrill, and the source for the second surveys is a book by Englehart, but I don't happen to remember the form in which the question was asked. Something that I've always speculated about is whether issues of translation from one language to another might be important in this regard. And the answer to that is I don't know either. Now, the second question that you raise, or rather the third question that you raise, is one in which I think I agree with you that the relative income idea has always been taken to be very subversive of price theory as we know it. And I think you see that in the resistance that economists have traditionally had. So a half a century ago, my colleague Dusenberry wrote a book about the relative income hypothesis. This was eagerly resisted. In the mid-1980s, Bob Frank from Cornell wrote a book about a particular form of the relative income hypothesis called, very interesting book called Choosing the Right Pond, met with vigorous resistance. More recently, Frank and others have been doing this. In the more technical literature, there are people like Konstantinides who have written about habit formation, and people like Abel who write about keeping up with the Joneses models. And while these models are now accepted within the technical refereed literature of economics, it's interesting to note that they're accepted only within one strand of the literature, and that's a strand in which one writes down a model of consumer behavior but does not use it to analyze consumers. All of the literature to which people like Abel and Konstantinides, for example, my colleague John Cochran, all of the literature to which they apply this is always in the context of applying it to asset pricing. So the issue is, why are stocks priced the way they are? But I do not think you will see in the literature, in the standard economics literature and the referee literature, a paper where somebody writes down one of these models and then goes on to use it to address behavior. So I infer from that the implication of your question is right. It must be very subversive of price theory as we know it, and where that will lead, nobody knows. Now, finally, on your question about loss aversion versus the risk aversion that naturally comes from the nonlinear, the concavity of the utility function, the answer is that loss aversion has a nonlinearity, or has a kink in it, it has a kink in the second derivative of the utility function, so that if you think about a conventional concave utility function that exhibits diminishing marginal utility, that gives you risk aversion in the sense that going up any given finite distance is not as much of a good as going down the same finite distance. But nevertheless, there's a smoothness property, so that going up by epsilon is approximately the same as going down by epsilon. There's a smoothness there. And the Kahneman-Tversky idea has a kink, a discontinuity there, so that going up epsilon is very different from going down epsilon. which incidentally in the discontinuity of course makes it harder to use this in formal analysis, because as soon as you go to use it in any context in which you're going to differentiate it and take a first order condition, you've immediately got a big problem.
Thanks. Let me ask a question. Don't you think there could be some sort of non-linearities depending in which stage of economic growth and structure you are? Let's say when I was considering the Russian problems about 15 years ago and Gorbachev and whatever, I always had the idea that Gorbachev somehow had inverted the order of priority by first democratizing and then trying to have development. And this is based on the fact that democracy, I think this was pointed out very clearly by Hicks in The Theory of Economic History, democracy has a cost. So once you have enough resources to sustain it, then maybe you get into this sort of virtuous cycle. But if you don't have them, it could be a completely different thing. Now, of course, it would be different to know exactly where the boundary is. But don't you think that there is a problem of having enough resources to begin to have a democratic process?
I can imagine that. And incidentally, what you say is very compatible with Barrow. You could read that implication out of the Barrow idea. I could imagine a variety of nonlinearities. Let me give you the nonlinearity that has emerged most strikingly in my work, and that is the experience of the Great Depression in the United States. When I look over the century and a half of American experience incidentally, you may have noticed that every time I was giving you examples of historical sequences of events in the United States, I was careful to go up to the 1920s, and then I skipped to the post World War II period. That was not an accident. The reason for that is that the great exception in American experience, at least for the 150 years for which we have good data, is the Depression experience. And you might say, now this was the period of all periods in which, at least in our country's experience, remember the United States was the United States was one of the two countries worst hit by the Depression. Depression was much worse in the United States than was in Britain. And you might say, if this hypothesis is to be true, there is the extremum. Shouldn't it have held there? Well, the historical truth is it didn't hold there. The Depression era and the response to the Depression was a remarkable broadening and opening of American society in many dimensions. Now, if we had time, I could go on at great length about different ideas about why the Depression experience was different, but one of the ideas that appeals to me is a form of nonlinearity argument, such that if I see myself in a situation of losing ground, I'm eager to make it up, if necessary, by elbowing ahead of other people. And if everybody sees themselves losing ground, then lots of elbows are flying. And of course, everybody can't get ahead of everybody else, and this just makes it all the more frustrating. But if we really think the whole system is collapsing out from under us, maybe this leads to some different form of interaction. So I am sympathetic to a variety of nonlinearities. And I should also say I'm sympathetic to the notion that there might be other circumstances under which the hypothesis either does or doesn't apply. But I think as a matter of intellectual strategy, what I would rather do is put the hypothesis forward in as bold and as universalistic looking a form as I can, and then let other people push back rather than start with all of the qualifications. But in the part of the book, this is all about a book, incidentally, in the part of the book on the Great Depression, there is an enormous discussion of why it was such an exception, and the nonlinearity idea is high on the list.
Right, we've got time for just one more question. There's a question up in the balcony. You'll have to shout.
Let's
We are good. There's what there is a. Hold on a moment. There is a microphone up there.
Let me ask a question about Latin America, where we have seen some economic growth, but income concentration, how does it fit into your arguments?
Well, again, if the economic growth, so-called, is highly concentrated, then I don't consider it growth. So my story is a story about what's happening to the broad cross-section of the population. And if there is measured GDP growth, but it does not accrue to the interest of the bulk of the population, then as far as my hypothesis is concerned, the driving variable is not characterized by growth. Or another way to make the same point is that for countries and time periods where we have the data, what I want to use is the median rather than the mean. And there are lots of examples. The United States is a perfectly good one. In the U.S. in the 1980s, it turned out that the mean growth of income wasn't too bad. It wasn't good, but it wasn't awful. What was awful was the median growth. And so I don't know which Latin American country you have in mind, and I'm not sure I'd know the specifics of it if you said, but to the extent that there is experience there in which the GDP grows and a small slice of the population claims most of the benefits, then I would not expect that to have the democratization implications that I am claiming for what I call economic growth.
Ben, thank you very much. I'm afraid we really don't have time for any more because, for one thing, any of you who want to are very welcome to join us all at a reception on the fifth floor in the senior common room. I must say that was absolutely splendid. When people say that economics is a narrow discipline, I hope they will remember your lecture tonight. It was also at one point where you talked about immigrants. My favorite story about Franklin Roosevelt is when he came to address a meeting of the Daughters of the American Revolution, the DAR, and began his speech with fellow immigrants. Anyhow, Ben, thank you very much indeed for giving us an absolutely splendid lecture.
Thank you.